Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be wrapping up our week-long conversation on soft power with Monocle's editorial team. And for those unable to wield their soft power abroad, we'll be offering a few fixes. Also today, we'll look at the new film Resistance, which reimagines the end of the Second World War. We'll be hearing from the film's director, Amit Gupta, and writer Owen Shears. All that, plus a couple of suitably soft power-related tunes, right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The Syrian government ignored Arab powers' moves to halt its crackdown on a pro-democracy uprising today, and more opposition supporters and military personnel were killed in unrelenting violence. The Syrian military said 10 personnel, including 6 pilots, were killed in an attack on an Air Force base, and that the incident proved foreign involvement in the 8-month revolt against President Bashar al-Assad's rule. Activists said government forces shot dead at least 4 demonstrators in the capital, Damascus, who were appealing for foreign intervention to stop the crackdown. They said 2 other civilians were killed in raids on their homes. Earlier today, a deadline set by the Arab League for Syria to sign a deal allowing peace monitors into the country expired without any government response. Turkey, meanwhile, said it could no longer tolerate any more bloodshed. This refugee appealed for the rest of the world to help.
We want Europe and the Arab countries to help us go back to Syria and to rid us of this oppressor so we can go back to Syria. If the oppressor stays, we will not go back. We will never, ever go back.
Tens of thousands of Egyptians demanding an end to military rule packed Cairo's Tahrir Square today in the biggest turnout of a week of protests and violence that has killed 41 people. The military rulers named a veteran former prime minister to head a new civilian cabinet, but that did little to appease the demonstrators who poured scorn on a name from the past. Kamal Ganzouri said the new government would not be announced before Monday, the date set for Egypt's first free parliamentary election in decades, which could be overshadowed if the violence continues. However, many aren't convinced the poll will make any difference.
Why should I vote? They can just play around with the country like before. Then what has the revolution accomplished?
I voted before, but what have they ever done for us? Once the elections are over, all the promises disappear.
Where are the revolutionary youth? Are any of them running? They haven't been given a chance to. Others have left them with nothing.
Kenyan police arrested 5 men today suspected of being members of Somalia's al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab insurgents on the island of Lamu, close to where 2 tourists were kidnapped and taken to Somalia. Kenya ordered soldiers across its border with Somalia in mid-October to crush al-Shabaab rebels who it said had kidnapped the tourists and attacked its security forces inside Kenya. Al-Shabaab has denied being behind the kidnappings. Unknown attackers kidnapped 3 Europeans and killed a 4th in the northern Mali town of Timbuktu today. A Malian government source said the nationality of the person killed was German. The nationality of the other people was not immediately known. The attack came a day after 2 French nationals were kidnapped from their hotel in the same region, where local agents for al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb operate. Gambia's President Yahya Jammeh secured a new 5-year term in the West African country today after the Election Commission declared him the winner in a poll regionally criticised as being marked by intimidation of voters and the opposition. Former military coup leader Jammeh scored a landslide 72% victory. The incumbent's victory was seen by many analysts as a foregone conclusion in the West African nation, which is regularly accused by rights groups of repression of dissent and muzzling of media. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. That election in Gambia was peculiar for one other reason as well, and that is the way that people voted. It wasn't with a normal, you know, ballot paper, pencil and pen on a bit of paper, or with a lever like in the US. Do you know what they used?
What?
Marbles.
Oh.
Each voter was given a marble and had to put it in one of 3 different containers, depending on which person they wanted to vote for. Yes, yeah. And perhaps not necessarily incredibly free and fair if People can see where you're putting your marbles.
Well, it sounds that there's doubt about the whole thing anyway.
There is, yes. But that's democracy Gambia style.
I'm afraid you wanted to end on a cheerful note in the news, but I'm afraid I can't find anything at the moment. No. Sorry to say.
I was slightly hoping it would be a nice sort of and finally story.
I'll look out for something for next time.
Yeah, let's look out for that for next time. But thank you very much for now, Nick. We are now going to cross over to Thomas Schaffernacker with the World Weather Report.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And let's start the weather with stormy Europe, and much of northern Europe will be experiencing severe winds, damaging at times this weekend. Heavy rain will accompany the storms. In some areas of northern Europe, winds may be gusting up to or over 120 kilometres an hour. Here's Saturday's city forecast. In London, 13 Celsius and windy conditions. Frankfurt, 7 degrees, partly cloudy. Rome, 15 Celsius and sunny. In Copenhagen, 6 degrees, high winds and showers. Air travel, certainly a potential for disruption at airports across Europe this weekend, given the impending stormy weather. That's from the UK to Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and possibly into northern Germany. For North America, a lot of sunny autumn weather across the entire eastern half of the United States this Friday, above average temperatures. However, Saturday, it'll start raining in the Midwest. Here's Saturday's city forecast. In New York City, 14 Celsius and cloudy. Washington, D.C., 14 degrees, also cloudy. Atlanta, 18 Celsius, partly cloudy. In San Francisco, the city by the bay, 18 Celsius and cloudy conditions. Let's have a look at Australia now. And wet weather is heading for Sydney and many other cities across southeastern parts of Australia. Looks like Friday and Saturday will have the wettest weather. But by Sunday, the clouds should break and the sun is back again. So Saturday's city forecast. In Sydney, 21 Celsius. Celsius and rain, Melbourne 21 degrees, also rain, Brisbane 27, sun and showers, and in Perth 26, partly cloudy. That's it, I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas Schaffernacker. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, all this week, we've been examining soft power around the world, what works and what doesn't. Last night, we held an event in association with the V&A here in London to discuss this very concept. There were just over 300 guests, many of whom were directly involved in the creation and dissemination of soft power from governments to cultural institutions. We'll be hearing a little bit of last night's discussion in a short while. But first of all, I'm joined in the studio by three rather recognisable voices from the Monocle team.
Don't look scared.
By Tyler Brûlé.
Hello.
By Robert Bound.
Cheers.
And by Andrew Tuck.
Hello.
Why are you saying cheers, Rob?
It's a birthday, cheers.
Oh, it is.
Happy birthday.
Oh, it wasn't for that. No, I just thought that it was just because of the water you were having.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, everyone in the studio is celebrating Tyler's birthday with a glass of wine, aside from me. For some reason,
well,
no one gave me
together.
The wine.
Oh, yes. You were supposed to go to a sting, and they were going to bring it in, but you didn't, so look what happened.
Oh, I see. It's like that, is it? Fine. Okay, we can do that later.
Power games in the studio. This is pretty much like the discussion we're going to have.
It is indeed. Yeah, how I'm going to control you three, I don't know. Sorry, crisps?
We've got crisps too.
Crisps, okay, excellent, good.
Great radio for crisps,
really good. Yeah, it'll go down really well in the studio. Now, we've been talking all week about who has soft power and who's been using it well. I thought it would be good to perhaps start off tonight's discussion on who doesn't have it and who's been trying to use it and has been a little bit disappointing. Andrew, since you've got the soft power issue open in front of you, why don't you kick us off?
And he's the one who's got a post-it note as well.
He's made notes.
It's the real small script sheet.
It just looks like a spider covered in ink scrawled across a post-it.
No, these are the things I'm buying for my supper tonight. Okay. No, this is my shopping list.
Okay, well, let's move on from your shopping list.
No, what I thought was interesting actually about all of the kind of countries that we've kind of looked at, and this is actually more branding actually than soft power. Admit it. I suddenly realised they've all got quite good flags. Apart from Britain, which is we always get up the wrong way. But I think actually a good place to start is with a good flag, and then you're well away, because actually you need something recognisable as your brand before you start. But the other good thing about most of the countries at the top, they've got an identifiable culinary, you know, kind of set of things that you associate with them for food. So whether that's UK for good or bad, but whether it's France, whether it's the US. So I think food is the way to kind of brand yourself. So I think it's very difficult if you're a country where you have little or no conception about what people eat there. So if you're, you know, the Tajikistan.
Uzbekistan.
Yeah, the stands. But, you know, I think that's also, you know, what makes it difficult for actually for African countries often to kind of stand out from the crowd is that, you know, and why they get lumped together is actually we find it very hard to kind of grasp what the difference is about their culture. You know, what, you know, and actually food is a really simple way of kind of dividing nations.
Mm. So I think just going back to that last, when you talked about the event last night, Steve, so many people came up to us at the reception afterwards and said, well, you know, we see the scientific elements that go into this. But when you look at those subjective components, and we were all around the table with Jonathan, really, thrashing it out. And what's interesting about that is I was saying to a lot of people, it goes right back to the point about cuisine. And I think it was probably the longest part of the discussion as well. It's like, how much do we like Chinese food versus, what Italy might have to offer versus Japan or Korea?
It was a sort of a key part of the discussion when we sat down with Jonathan McClory at the Institute for Government and tried to work out those extra sort of more subjective things.
Yeah, and I think a good example, a country which of course has very much been in the news this week, is Bahrain. And we saw, rewind 18 months ago, and the amount of money that Bahrain was spending on television, in newspapers, in magazines, outdoor advertising about, why it was great to do, business in Bahrain. And as soon, one small element goes wrong, and yet now there's nothing left. And you think about sort of the essence of the country. Of course, there's a deployment of U.S. troops, and yes, it still might be a place with an okay airline. But oddly, you come back to issues of the two. Maybe it is the two C's though. It's cuisine and it's culture.
Rob, looking at those that perhaps don't have soft power or perhaps use it rather unwisely, who are the ones that stand out for you?
Well, on the cuisine and culture thing, I wanted to, I don't know whether I can add a third C to that, unfortunately, without keeping in the boundaries of the broadcast rules. But it is, I think there's the idea, just to add to that, is the idea of how old your culture seems to the rest of the world, whether people visit your country to visit, whether they're visiting frescoes or whether they're visiting, want to see the contemporary art and contemporary theatre and all the rest of it, is that strong thing of how magnetic your theatres and art galleries and all the rest of it is, or whether people are just turning up to look at the mountains and the forest and all the rest of it. I think that's sort of a big deal. One of the countries, as a case in point, and I spoke to Bruce Leishman when I was hosting this show earlier in the week, was Russia, which is full of cultural riches, but they've sold very badly because from the outside people still have this Soviet view of Russia and a very old-fashioned sort of Pravdary view of the country, which it's struggling to change because it seems still very authoritarian and all the rest of it. So their hard power is doing their soft power no favours at all.
So even if they're spending a huge amount of money on hosting the Winter Olympics in Sochi or having the Football World Cup in 2018, actually, if you're still seen as a rather nasty authoritarian regime, then it really doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, and I just want to pick up one other little thing on that kind of cultural element. I think that another thing that came up that was interesting yesterday at the discussion was the value of a good brand. And it was, again, it's interesting that you look at a country like Austria, a very successful country, great culture, but it kind of lacks that brand edge, doesn't it? That, you try and name, we can name one or two brands, but you try and go beyond the Swarovskis of this world, then what else can you list that's Austrian? And actually, sending stuff out in the world in a soft way that, that's why Germany's so good, because so many of its brands we know are efficient and they sell Germanness to the world. But somehow if you're Austria, it's a bit difficult to kind of, because you're seen as Germanic, you can't quite hitch a ride on the German bus. But so I think you also the countries that do well, they have really good national brands that kind of sell themselves around the world.
And of course, if you stay in the neighborhood, then you go to Switzerland, and then Switzerland has no problem. And you can rattle off the biggest names of brands across a variety of key sectors, which are also essential to daily life.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of those as well fit a certain Swiss stereotype.
Absolutely.
If you were a Swiss theater company, you might struggle.
But it's the funny thing, you almost need the stereotype to kind of, you can tinker with it, you can hone it a little bit. You need some sort of, I think better to have a stereotype than no stereotype at all, right?
No, it's very absolutely. And I think that the other side too is that you can push on cuisine and culture, but then if you don't have the B, which is brands, and of course you need the national condition to set that up, and you need the economic climate, and of course you need the education, all those things to underpin that level of business. Otherwise you wouldn't have a Nestle. But I think it's and I think Simon Anholt made a very good point about a Sweden, and I think Sweden Sweden does well in pop music. It's done well with television and film, and it also is able to get inexpensive clothing and furniture in front of pretty much anyone in the world.
Well, I think on Sweden he raised a very interesting point last night, which was actually Sweden's not as good as we think it is, or his argument was.
Yeah.
And is that fair? Someone who's, who goes to Sweden quite often?
I think that there is, well, I almost sort of read that also, that Simon Anholt was also sort of saying that, it's not as good as almost as they think it is. And I'm conflicted about that, because when I was actually, you know, you put this issue to bed and you sort of and you relook at things, and I watched, you know, the second series of The Killing, and I was thinking, God, you know, that's just good television, and maybe, you know, maybe Denmark deserved to do better. And sort of you wonder, what will the power of Hollywood remaking the Millennium films, and what will that do for the Swedish brand? So, you know, I think the Swedes, you know, do a pretty good job. I think the problem, though, is that they're a little bit too smug about it.
That's the thing. I almost think that Sweden's slight, if there is, if I mean, we're looking at it under such a microscope and looking at it in a way that possibly lots of people wouldn't. And I think that if Sweden is slightly fraying around the edges, or even if it is colouring around the edges slightly, most people possibly wouldn't notice that. But it might even be a good thing, because it makes this perfect, slightly smug social democracy a little bit more real. You know,
I want to add something which. I mean, it's a very superficial kind of thing, but I wondered what actually a lot of these countries, whether there's, you know, in our stereotype of them, the people actually are somehow physically attractive as well. You know, there's something about
we didn't mention this.
But when you think of the stereotype of an Australian, it's a person on a beach. You think of Brazil does very well at soft power. There's a physicalness about those places, and I wonder actually whether that dents someone's soft power when, you know, that image of, say, America 30 years ago was of, you know, the Californian surfer, and now actually through stereotypes, it's kind of, you know, of the fat person.
It's the fat person getting on an American Airlines flight.
And does that dent your national brand? You know, so it's not surprising that all the Nordic nations are there in the top nations. There's something about, you know, how people eat, which obviously reflects in their kind of their physicality, how they use the outdoor, whether they're couch potatoes. There's something about us desiring to be like the person that helps soft power, I think.
So when we do this next year, are we going to have a how good looking are you people?
Topless power will be next year.
Topless power.
Yeah.
Excellent. Do I don't know where to laugh or cry.
I'm happy to edit this next year, guys, if you need any help.
Now he offers to help. Excellent. One other thing I wanted to touch on before we play a little bit of a soft power related music, which I would love to take credit for, but I'm going to lay the blame all on Rob's shoulders, is how do those countries at the bottom of our survey, or those that we didn't even bother looking at because we simply don't think they're important enough, how do they gain soft power? And one of the things that Simon Anholt said last night was when countries say to come to him and say, we have a crap image, he says, well, maybe you're a crap country.
Mm.
Is there really anything, he's a bit forceful perhaps.
Yes.
Is there actually anything that countries that are, say, number 30 in our list or don't even make our top 50 can actually do?
Yeah, I think there are a number of good countries which, you know, certainly don't make the top 30. And as you know, I'm not sure if everyone has been saying it on their programs throughout the week, but if you make the top 30, you know, chances are you're doing, you know, a number of things very well. But I think it's China who's just crept in at number 30, I believe, correct?
Yes.
And they are, you know, a new entry. And am I right, or was it Greece?
No, Greece was, Greece snuck in there at number 30.
God bless them.
China was number 20.
Oh, China was number, so they just made it into the top 20. But yeah, of course, there are a number of other countries, you know, even around this neighborhood, you know, who are not on the list. I don't think Ireland is there, for example.
No.
And I'm sure there'll be lots of O'Grady's and Keogh's are very angry about that. Nevertheless, though, I think that, you know, if you take, you know, it's not a bottom of the league table. I'm sure that, you know, Ireland is probably top 40 if we went and did this. Yes, there are a number of things that Ireland could do, I think, to make its way, you know, up the rankings. And I think one of them would be, it's not just about saying, oh, well, we've got the European headquarters for Facebook there. It's, you know, it's not just the fact that, you know, well, once upon a time we had some decent banks. You know, I think that they also have to, you know, whether it's, you know, more investment, you know, in the arts, you know, does RT have to come up with a great television series? There are some probably quite simple things that you could do to get back in the game. If you're a properly crap country, I don't think there's no amount of branding work, cosmetic work, or hosting a major global summit that's going to help you.
The only interesting thing is when it comes to sport, and actually there are a few kind of countries which actually ain't that great that actually have quite a good soft power influence through sport. So for example, Ethiopia, you know, it hasn't got exactly the most kind of democratic government at the moment, and
no,
it doesn't exactly treat people very well. But actually, it's got amazing sprinters, and it has a kind of amazing culture of running that actually people around the world actually quite like Ethiopia, know Ethiopia for.
And also, great music and great food.
You don't know any Ethiopian runners?
Nor do you. What are you, the sports editor suddenly?
Highly Gabby Sebastian.
I was out of the office. I must have been eating birthday cake. I missed that memo.
One at the moment.
I know you do. That's why you're so tall.
I think we're going to play our first song. I don't know whether you're going to stick around for after the song. No, shakes mm-hmm. the head.
No,
I'm especially not once you've heard it.
But this is an example of I think it's a good example of Russian soft power. This song changed the image of Russia all around the world when it first came out.
Is it Fiddler on the Roof?
It's not quite, no. It's not quite. So we're going to play that in a second, but before then.
Is it Matt Monro from Russia with Love?
No. You can keep guessing.
It's later. Oh.
Yeah, it is later.
We're going to keep guessing. You can keep guessing off that. But until then, Tyler, Rob, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Tattoo. That was Tattoo, All the Things She Said. You didn't expect to hear that on Monocle 24, did you? Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Last night, in association with the V&A, Monocle held an event that gathered some of the leading thinkers, on soft power. Among the speakers were nation branding expert Simon Anholt, Lawrence Decars, scientific director of the Agence France Museums, Lord David Howe from the Foreign Office, and Martin Roth, director of the V&A. The debate was chaired by Monocle's very own Tyler Brulé.
Simon, on the topic that I'm going to put you in the hot seat first, because I'm sure you have lots of governments knocking on your door on the topic of soft power. When a nation comes to you and says, Simon Anholt, I'd like a bit of soft power in my life, what is your definition?
I have to admit that I'm the only person in the United Kingdom who doesn't much like the term soft power. Soft power sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? It sounds as if you're hitting people with something not very effective. And I think the whole point about culture, for example, is that you're not hitting people, and it is very effective. And the idea of power is also a bit dodgy, because it suggests that you have agency over people. In the context of culture, it suggests that what you're doing is you're rolling your culture up into a bullet and firing it at people.
Right.
And people don't like that, rather unsurprisingly.
Laurence, what is the state in France at the moment? So that level of engagement between the Élysée Palace and your institutions?
I have no big ideas about soft power from France, and I'm afraid that such a thing doesn't exist, actually. Frankly, the image of France is awful, generally speaking. We are arrogant, pretentious, we know how to do things the whole world doesn't know. You know, it's awful. I mean, it's really... So, really, it's not about that. But we know a few things about museum culture and heritage, and we want to share this knowledge, to train people also there, to be in charge at a later stage of their own institutions and heritage. This is the whole picture, you know, is a bigger one, something that is a bit of a laboratory, probably, for French museums. And this very new international landscape, a new possibility of exchanges, of collaborations at a scale that has never been done, you know, before. So, no big ideas about, you know, the French side of soft power, but really definitely some ideas about how a big project can be carried and what difficulties it goes through also.
Lord Howell, do you think this is something that you could ever envisage the Foreign and Commonwealth Office engaging in something like we're seeing right now in Abu Dhabi, that you would have this type of involvement to take major institutions abroad from this country and really facilitate and have them plunk down, whether it's in the Gulf or somewhere else?
Well, I find this fascinating, because the truth is we think of hardly anything else. We're deeply involved, not only in the UAE, but in through all the GCC states, but in fact right across the whole network of nations, both inside and outside the Commonwealth. One of my day jobs is Minister of the Commonwealth, 54-nation network of English-speaking, wonderful overlap with the Francophonie, and with the efforts and aims of the French government to promote their reputation, establish their influence in the same way that the British government tries to do as well, because nowadays this is the currency.
Martin, I wanted to ask you, before arriving at this institution, what was the relationship where you were sitting with Berlin, with the Auslandsministerium, and type of dialogue? Obviously there was an engagement, I guess, with an exhibition in China and some interesting timing around that. Was there this recognition on the part of the foreign ministry of how not just your past institution, but others within the Federal Republic could be used.
This idea of culture as diplomacy, I think it's a real old topic. Look in our collections everywhere. This is a collection that comes from all over Europe, or all over the world, and was related to politics always. After the war, I think it started in the 60s with this idea to have third column. In Germany, it was Willy Brandt with this idea, economy, politics, and this third column is culture. And since that time, they started to support it somehow. Maybe it was related to the end of the Cold War. If you support culture, if you support cultural institutions, it's even easier to handle conversation with those countries that are politically wise really difficult.
Simon, I wanted to ask you, oftentimes when you're engaged and talking to leaders or ministries around the world, how often does it come up that, you know, one of the first things you say is, you have to look at what your cultural exports are, your institutions, et cetera. Is it in your sort of the top three things in your grab bag, or is it further down?
It really depends on what the starting point is. We live in a very large and very busy, very interconnected world, where almost by definition, people can't know very much about you. Last time I checked, there were 205 countries. Now, almost nobody, except the sort of people who are in this room, really know anything about any of those countries. And so what's left? What's left is people's prejudices and their beliefs, which are deeply rooted cultural constructs, very, very hard to shift. But image, or that awful word brand, the brand image of a country, it's not a term I like, as you very well know.
Of course.
Just for various obvious reasons, it makes it sound like a marketing trick, which it certainly isn't, because marketing is just not powerful enough to shift such a gigantic construct. If you want a different reputation, you're going to have to earn it somehow, not just talking about it. I mean, look, bragging about how great you think you are, as this country is doing at the moment with a ludicrous campaign, trying to tell people how great Britain is the exact equivalent of a stand-up comedian standing on the stage and saying, I'm really funny. You know, if you want people to laugh, you have to tell jokes. And in the same way that if you want a better reputation, you've got to earn it.
Martin, I wanted to ask you, do you think it's one of the best exports that we have in this nation at the moment?
Yeah, but we're sitting in a museum right now. We're talking in a museum, and I think this is the strength of a museum that you have. I mean, there's evidence. It's a three-dimensional object. It's not only about theory of research. Here's the proof of what happened in different parts of the world, and that's the real strength. This is always something that you can build up new theories and discussions or whatever. The V&A that is definitely made, I mean, for 115 years now, for creative ideas and innovations and to discuss it. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I like our debate tonight. But coming back to you, Simon, do you think that a cultural institution helps to create a brand for a country, for a nation?
Certainly, one of the things that my research has showed me over the years is that unless people believe that you have culture, they don't believe in you as a nation. Culture in the minds of international public opinion, and bear in mind, I say this in the nicest possible way, but public opinion has a mental age of 7. And one of the things that my research has shown me over the years is that 7-year-old makes a very, very simple equation about culture, which is if you are perceived to have culture, whatever that means, then you are perceived to have self-respect, and therefore you are worthy of respect. The countries that are not regarded as having culture receive very little respect. So the cultural institutions are simply the means by which that is communicated and shared with other people. So the countries that don't have the institutions need to create them and need to build them.
Those were the highlights from Monocle's Soft Power Summit, which was held at the V&A here in London last night. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. It's approaching 18:32 here in London, 19:32 in Salzburg, where we'll be heading in a moment. Later in the show, we'll also be hearing from the team behind the new film Resistance, which reimagines a very different end to the Second World War. But first, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks very much, Steve. The Syrian government has ignored Arab powers' moves to halt its crackdown on a pro-democracy uprising, and more opposition supporters and military personnel were killed in unrelenting violence. Tens of thousands of Egyptians demanding an end to military rule packed Cairo's Tahrir Square today in the biggest turnout of a week of protests and violence that has killed 41 people. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has nominated a former central bank governor to take up the post again, nearly 6 months after the incumbent left, saying he feared for his life because of his role investigating a banking scandal. Bahrain will start new talks on political reforms and overhaul its security policies, but still blames Iran for fomenting civil unrest when protesters inspired by Arab Spring uprisings took to the streets this year. Moroccans have voted in a parliamentary election that could yield their most representative government ever, after King Mohammed ceded some powers to prevent any tumultuous spillover of Arab Spring uprisings. Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev's eldest daughter is set to return to politics after being named as a parliamentary election candidate, but analysts said it was premature to conclude she was being groomed to succeed her father. Mexican human rights activists want the International Criminal Court to investigate President Felipe Calderón. Top officials and the country's most wanted drug trafficker accusing them of allowing subordinates to kill, torture and kidnap civilians. Gambia's President Yahya Jammeh secured a new five-year term in the West African country today after the Election Commission declared him the winner in a poll regionally criticised as being marked by intimidation of voters and the opposition. And global supermarket chains welcomed a long-awaited invitation from India to invest in the country's $450 billion retail market, but they fear the small print may keep a lid on investment in the short term. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, for another tune, which shows just exactly how far soft power can go without many of us even noticing. That was Julie Andrews singing one of the much-loved songs from the 1965 film Sound of Music. The musical set in Salzburg is, for many people, one of the few cultural exports from Austria. Recently, The Sound of Music went home. It's the first time the production has been staged in Salzburg, where the story is set. But it's not quite striking the same note with Austrian audiences as it has with the rest of us. I'm now joined on the line by Reinhard Wagenleitner, Associate Professor of Modern History at the University of Salzburg. Professor Wagenleitner, thanks for joining us today. Have you seen the production yourself?
Well, first of all, thanks for the invitation and welcome from Salzburg to London. I have not seen the production myself because it's completely sold out. It's sold out until next spring.
Wow. So it's been a huge success in one sense then.
It's an absolute smashing success, and congratulations have to go to the production team and the director, Carl Philipp von Maldegin, because no one could expect, after 50 years of ignorance about Sound of Music in Salzburg, that it would be such a wonderful success.
And why has it taken so long for a production to take place in Salzburg, do you think?
Well, there are many reasons, and that would take more time than we have. But I think one of the most important reasons is that just imagine that an Austrian film team with the best actors and the best musicians would go to Liverpool and do a film about the Beatles in German. And so the film, the music to Austrians just doesn't sound authentic. That's one of the reasons. When the film came out, I mean, I was about 15 years old, and I was completely into the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the rest of that kind of story and the blues. So the music to me sounded completely syrupy. And I think the most important thing is that on the cultural level, the music, much more than the story, it was the music, which is wonderful music by Rodgers and Hammerstein. But the film also, we have this very sad practice of dubbing everything. It's mostly dubbed in German and not in Austria. So you have to imagine that you have the Sound of Music dubbed into German. Even the songs were dubbed into German.
Even the songs as well?
Even the songs as well, and they were horrible. I mean, this has nothing to do with the compositions. I hope you understand that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, you say it's sold out all the way through till spring. Are the people that are going to it actually enjoying it? Do people who've seen it think, yes, this is a great production and was worth waiting for?
Yes. It is absolutely, to the surprise of everybody, press, radio, television. Just before talking to you, I looked up everything I could find online because, of course, I followed it, but I just wanted to be absolutely precise, and I have not seen one negative review. I mean, even a local newspaper, which, of course, was part originally of the doubters, even the local newspapers in Salzburg are talking about a smashing success. So the producers of this show in Salzburg actually also knew the problems with the translation of the film, and they had the whole music translated by new translators, and they also strengthened the political side of the production, not only the love story and the family story, and the children are absolutely, in all the reviews I read, it's the children in the choir and in the play who are the real stars of this production. So yes, it is a smash success.
Now, outside of Austria, you know, the Sound of Music is, you know, arguably one of the few things that that the country is known for, that is identifiably Austrian, even though, as you say, it's the whole thing was done by people who weren't Austrian at all. Do you think that Austria is finally beginning to embrace the Sound of Music and accept, you know, this musical as one of their own?
Well, yes and no. I think we can't talk about Austria, and it's the people in the audience. Salzburg is very close to Bavaria, so there are a lot of German people also coming to this show. I don't think that we could say Austria is embracing the musical, but it's more open. It's a new generation. I think if you talk about the reception of the Sound of Music in anywhere, it's much more a musical for a female audience, for a white audience in the United States, and in the rest of the world. Of course, if you go to Asia, then the white, which I use on the inverted commas, of course, doesn't work. But it's we do have a new generation of viewers who enthusiastically also answered the call for people coming to perform, and before they were even coming into the cast. So the whole PR before the show was done so professionally. Was done so professionally that I think it was done one of the instances where in Austria you could argue, not only in Salzburg, in Austria, that this was really done in a global sense, in a highly professional sense, PR-wise, but also casting-wise.
And do you think, is there a case to be made that the reason it's come back now at this stage is that, you know, this was a film that was based on events, you know, during the Second World War. They're obviously, you know, although the film is obviously very lighthearted, the musical is very lighthearted, it's talking about quite a dark period in our history. Do you think the fact that we're now, you know, more than 60 years after the end of the Second World War makes it a bit easier to celebrate a film like this?
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because although this was one of the darkest moments of Austrian history, it's usually blamed on the Germans, but it has to be blamed as much on Austrian history, of course. And I'm a historian, and I know that very much. It's the reason why I became a historian, is because we were involved in this, probably one of the worst crimes in human history. But I don't think that this was the reason why the film failed in the 60s, because so many British or American war movies, which correctly showed the Germans, including the Austrians, armies and soldiers losing, I mean, they were big successes, so I don't think it's the political side that made it fail then, but more the cultural side.
Okay, Reinhard Wagenleitner, thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you eventually get a ticket.
Well, we already have applied for them and we will get them. Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye to London.
Thank you very much. We're now going to go to another song and we're going to keep on our soft power theme. This is Run DMC versus Aerosmith. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. A few years ago, award-winning poet Owen Shears published his first novel, Resistance. The story offers a retelling of the final year of the Second World War, explaining what might have happened if Germany had invaded the UK. A film version is released in the UK today. A little earlier, I spoke to the writer Owen Shears and the director of the film, Amit Gupta. Where did the original idea come from, and how long did it take to go from being an idea to an actual novel?
They're both very good questions, but they're always sort of the hardest questions, I think, sometimes to answer retrospectively, and you always have to check that you are actually being truthful. And so, of course, the truest part of that first question is that I think, you know, novels tend to start in many places, and that was certainly the case for this one. But I suppose there were two very significant, specific starting places, and one was actually the landscape of South Wales, where I was brought up. My previous book had been set in and about Zimbabwe, and I guess one of the biggest challenges of writing that was to sit in my study back here in the UK and to bring the Zimbabwean veil off the page in a way that it really lived. And so I think I went looking for a story that I could set in the Black Mountains. I think I knew that I'd be writing with a significant head start, if you like, if I set a novel.
So you're trying to make it easier for yourself, basically.
I was trying to make it easier.
Yeah.
I was trying to make it easier. But then that actually intersected with starting to hear stories from people in their sort of mid-80s, their late 80s, about how they'd been recruited into a secret organisation called the Auxiliary Units in 1940-41. And this organisation would have been essentially Britain's civilian insurgency in the event of a Nazi occupation of Britain during World War II. And one of these people was a farmer who I'd known all of my life, a farmer called George Vater. And I went to talk to him, and I think that conversation was that second really significant starting point.
And had you known anything about George's past before this came up?
No, for many years he actually drove the minibus to school. And I thought he was the local farmer who drove the minibus. And I didn't. I had actually heard rumours about this organisation when I was working as a builder in the Llantony Valley when I was 18. But to be honest, I thought that they were exaggerated stories. But it turns out that they were based in a very real truth, quite a chilling truth, which involved sort of around 3,500 to 4,000 men and women being recruited, 350 underground bunkers built throughout Britain, and these people being expected to physically go underground to wait for the occupation to pass, and then they would surface to begin their acts of sabotage. But what I became interested in straight away wasn't so much the men in the bunkers as the people who they would have left behind. And that's really where the book was born. The idea of six farm women waking up in a very isolated valley one day and finding that their husbands have simply gone, which is how both the book and the film start. A few weeks later, a patrol of mostly quite young German soldiers moves into the valley, and over the course of a very harsh winter, these two groups, the occupiers and the occupied, are forced into a situation of, I suppose, mutual dependency. So that's really the heart of the story.
Let's move on to sort of how it became a film. Was it something that you had thought yourself it had potential for a film, or you would like to? I mean, I guess everyone who writes a book thinks, oh, this could just make a very fine film. I'd like to sell the rights to this for a tidy sum.
Well, actually, it's funny you should say that, because I genuinely didn't think that when I was writing Resistance. I think I was just concerned with trying to write a good novel, which I was finding hard enough. But the first time I started thinking about it, really, was when the book came out in America, and I was based over in New York for 2 years. And some people at those readings began to ask, you know, is this going to be a film? And, of course, I did find that quite a potent question. So when I met Amit, that's what I sort of asked him when I handed in the book. I said, you know, what do you think?
And so it starts like that, the two of you meeting and him handing you a book.
Essentially.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we met at a dinner party and we were weirdly dressed very similarly.
And you had said you weren't going to mention that.
He had a bag, this leather bag, that was identical to a bag I found in a hedge in Bologna.
Not actually your bag.
No, not my bag. I saw this bag in a hedge, and I can't really even tell you, it's a weird thing. It was full of blank stationery. I took it back to the family I was staying with and said, you know, we should take this to the police, and they laughed at me. So you're in Italy, you don't take things, it's yours. So I've got this bag that's the same as Owen's bag, except I found it in a hedge in Italy.
And I found mine in a hedge in Wales.
Okay.
And it didn't have anything inside it.
But anyway, the point was, we got on at this dinner and Owen was moving to New York and said, if you're in New York, give me a call. And I was going over there for a film festival. And so I gave him a call and said, do you want to come and see some of these movies at this festival? And I took him to the worst Bollywood film ever seen. But he liked my film, so he gave me his book to read, and I took it away with me, and I read it on the plane. And I rather ambitiously thought this should be my first film, given that it's a period movie set during the Second World War with horses, animals and weapons.
So your specialist subjects?
Absolutely, and I knew that as a first-time director, it would be easy to set that up.
So it was quite serendipitous. It was a chance meeting at a dinner party. Yeah. The fact that you were wearing the same clothes, you had similar bags, you happened to be in New York, you took into a terrible film.
Yeah.
That's how films are made.
All these things were leading to one thing and one thing only.
But the art was the pitch when I said to Owen that I'd love to make this film. I'd love to make a film with your novel, and this is how I would do it. And it will be the independent European film. That's what I want to make out of this film. It will be, if you want to classify it, it'll definitely be the art house end of films. Nobody's going to finance me to make a Hollywoodized version, but, you know, he didn't want the big Hollywoodized version. I mean, the things I was insistent on that I would do and were things he was clear about as well, that the Germans would speak German, we wouldn't have silly accents, you know, and we would cast it authentically and we would try and capture the atmosphere of the novel.
And how did the two of you find working together on this? Because, you know, often someone, you know, writes a book, someone adapts a screenplay, lots of other people get involved, and the relationship between the original writer and the director is often lost in there. Mm. How closely did the two of you work together?
Well, actually, we worked together very closely, and more or less straight away from the off. It happened very, very naturally. And I should say it's my first experience of co-writing. And how we did it, actually, was really quite straightforward. The first day of writing, I think we only wrote about a page of the script. But what we were doing was we were actually searching for that shared voice of the screenplay. Once we had that, we really got cracking. And we would take sort of 5 or 10 scenes each. We would write those scenes and then swap. And then we would go through each other's scenes straight away and then swap again and again. So by the time you've done that 2 or 3 times, no individual writer actually has a real sense of ownership over that scene. They feel like very genuinely shared scenes. And also, actually, the fact that I was living in the States and Amit was here, it might sound odd, but that was an amazing asset because it meant the script was sometimes worked on for 34, 36 hours at a time. And so it came together remarkably quickly.
And what sort of release is it getting? Obviously, it's coming out here in the UK on Friday. What about elsewhere in the world?
At the moment, the strategy behind a lot of these sort of films is it opens in the UK, it's had good press in the UK, so as a result, on the back of that, you hope that the sales agent will use that to sell worldwide, and, you know, there is interest abroad, but it all starts here.
We went to so much effort early on in terms of the tone of the film, you know, and we were always sure that we wanted to have a very bold adaptation that was faithful to the tone, so I guess to a certain extent, even at this very late stage, we want to sort of make sure that the tone of how the film is put out there is also true to the film that you'll see.
When you talk about, you know, you want to perhaps work on another project together, do you have things in mind or are you still trying to...
Yeah, we've got one book in particular that I'd love to tell you and I'll come back and tell you what it is once the deal goes through.
That's quite all right.
That we like to do together and we think that's going to happen. It's got to have worked, really, because if you're prepared to sacrifice half your fee...
I never thought of it that way, but that's true.
That is absolutely true. But you know, the flip side is we wrote the first draft in 5 weeks and it was better than a first draft I would have written in, you know, whatever I'd get for a screenplay, 10 weeks. You're already further down the line and, you know, you could probably do twice as much work with a co-writer and it's more enjoyable. So it's just a better experience. I think it's better for me in terms of the way I'm built. Psychologically, it's better. I don't go quite as mad when I'm co-writing.
That was Amit Gupta and Owen Shears, the team behind the new film Resistance, which is released in the UK and Ireland today. That almost brings us to the end of this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Constance Cheng, our researcher Alberto Pickers, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Nick Kelly is here with headlines in just a moment. Then at the top of the hour, it's time for The Menu. Now, next Monday, Midori House will not be coming from Midori House itself. We'll be on the road. Washington, D.C. on Monday, New York City on Tuesday. I'll be hosting in D.C. and I think Tyler is hosting in New York. We're going to end with one last song linked to soft power. If soft power can be summed up in a single phrase, it is all about creating good vibrations about your country. This is the Beach Boys. Goodbye. I love the colourful clothes she wears, and she's already working on my back.